So today I taught the 17th annual Poetry Day at Spirit Rock. And what this means is that I choose a theme of some Dharma point, and then over the course of a period of weeks, choose the poems that would fit that theme as best I can do so. And I collect the poems all year long, usually not knowing what the theme's going to be until some weeks before. And it's a laborious process. It takes many, many hours to do. And it's like one of those Tibetan sand paintings. We do all this, and then it's all gone. And so when I say a lot of hours, I mean, I counted this time about 60 hours of prep time for something that's going to come and go in a relatively short period of time. One can't do that many times a year because there's just not that much time available. And appropriately enough, given my comments, this year's theme was about exploring our relationship with time. And this is a very broad-ranging subject, something I didn't get into today at all with the group, is that there's a big question about what time is in the first place. And if I were going to say, I would talk about it as a spectrum of possibilities more than anything else. It's a spectrum of possibilities that are splayed out ahead, and one of them in any given moment gets chosen, and then another one for a series of reasons, sort of mysterious. But that's not what we're going to get into tonight either, because that's very heady and not so relevant to our lives, as the fact is that we are, as human beings, we're forced to relate to time for all sorts of reasons. Because we're born, therefore we live in time, and we die because we're born in time. Anything the Buddha said that is born in time ceases in time. And that includes all of us and all those things we care about. So that alone forces the relationship. We also live in a culture that's very time-based. As you know, Americans work longer hours per week than most of the industrialized world, and advanced economy world, sometimes referred to now. And we also are sort of unique in our reluctance to take our vacation time. It's been allotted. There's a huge percentage of people do not take their vacation time, and it gets gone. It's taken away. Some people get paid for it, but many people don't take it, and it disappears on them. And yet they still don't take it. Again, this is because of particular peculiarities in our culture that this kind of thing occurs. So then there's also the choice of what we do in a minute, in a day, an hour, a week, a month, a year. We make choices as to what we spend our time on. And the argument can be made that the one thing we sort of own, only sort of, but we sort of own our time. And so what we are doing and the way we're spending our time is we're spending what we own. We have more choice, maybe, to some degree, over how we spend our time than a lot of other things that are so condition-based. Of course, we have the necessities that take up our time, but what we choose to see as a necessity can vary a lot. There are people who have voluntarily chosen the homeless life in modern times and not to be, a monastic, but in fact just do not want to be in regular time life. They don't like it. It doesn't fit. It's disquieting to them and so forth. So if we are in regular time life, we still are choosing what's important to us by how we spend our time. And each of us are already choosing this. I sometimes run into people, particularly in my other work, working around change and transitions with people, but in general I run into people who say, well, I'm still trying to decide what I'm going to do with my time. And I say, nope. You've already decided. You may be considering a revision of what you do with your time, but you are right now making the decision. You can say that you're passive about it. You let others decide for you, or you let circumstances or whatever it is. But nonetheless, we're all spending our time. I chose to spend the day doing what I was doing. I chose to spend all those hours in prep. And I like what I do, but there are things I don't do that I also like. So I am making a choice based on some sort of priority. So as each of you in the room, you are making choices all the time, but not necessarily recognizing them. So if you don't make a conscious choice, how do choices get made? The momentum of our lives carry us on from one thing to the next. That's one way it does. We've all been conditioned that this is how you're supposed to spend your time. There are goals that we have been conditioned to, or maybe we've chosen for ourselves, that take a lot of our time as we go towards those goals. We don't often pause and say to ourselves, am I making the choice right now that I would be choosing to make? And I don't mean in this moment, but I mean in general in relation to how much time we work or who we spend our time with. It's our very precious object. It's finite. And it goes through stages of robustness, both over an arc of time and during periodic times when we're sick or not sick and so forth that we have, and yet we don't necessarily consider all these things in making decisions in our life. So that's one whole level of time, and that way of these precious chips that we're gambling that if we spend our time doing X or Y, that is what's going to bring us some degree of satisfaction, some degree of meaning. We're betting on that. It's a bet. It's a best judgment bet. It's not something else, because it's not guaranteed we're right. So it's not that we're exchanging 2 years or 20 years or 40 years of our life, say of all our work days, to be the school teacher or to be the physician or to be a soccer coach or whatever it is we choose to do, that we know that we get a certain amount of something back. We don't know what we get back. It is a gamble. It's a best choice gamble. And it calls for periodic reevaluations as to how I am spending my time. Am I spending it the ways that feels most vital, most real for me? Or am I doing what I was doing and momentum carries me forward, or other people want me to be spending my time doing this, so I'm spending my time doing it because other people want. Or this is the expectation, and I'm spending my time based upon some group of people's expectation, my family of origin, my own family, my friends, the larger community I'm part of, or some religious group or some other kind of group that I'm part of. But how do I feel about this? What do I want to do with my time? And very relevant question. The other set of considerations about time, which I used as the basis for choosing and allocating the poems today, was a set of beliefs we have about time, which are not exactly right, but not wrong either. And we can each examine ourselves in terms of these beliefs. The first of them is that time is precious. Oh, time is precious. We only have so much time I'm a certain age, I've only got so much time left. Or, oh, I'm in my salad days, and these are so precious, and they're only going to last so long. Oh, I'm under 30, and I'm still in my 20s, and that's really precious, this time under my 20s. Or my 30s, because, you know, at 40, you're stuck with being an adult. whatever it is that we're believing, that makes time precious. And oftentimes we get set in a view about it, and then we don't consider it even more. In my my work with Change and Transitions, I take people through a chart of development that's based on the age you are and all of that, that came out of this professor at Harvard's work, where he did a lot of survey work on this. So time is precious. Do you believe that or not believe that? Sometimes time is a burden. Sometimes it's precious, maybe. So there's this relationship to it. I'll actually read you a poem about this. I wasn't going to do this, but I will. This is talking about how time and whether time stays feeling precious or not. And it's by a woman named Deborah Cummings. And it's called At a Certain Age. He sits beside his wife, who takes the wheel. Clutching coupons, he wanders the aisles of stop and save. There's no place he must be, no clocks to punch. Sure, there are bass in the lake, a balsam model in the garage, the par 3 back 9, but it's not the same. Time, the enemy then, time, the enemy now. As he points the remote at the screen or pauses at the window, staring into the neighbor's fence, but not really seeing it, he listens to his wife in the kitchen, more amazed than ever, how women seem to know what to do with time. How women seem to know what to do. How with their cycles and timers, their rolling boils and their 3-minute eggs, they wait for something to start or stop. A poem of someone who has lost their relationship to time. Time is not precious in the experience of for the subject of this poem. Now, if this person was told they had 6 months to live, switch an attitude. So what we believe in terms of time being precious is based on a wider set of perceptions, but also based on what our circumstances are. Because when we're told there's little of it, we're much more interested in it than there's a lot. We're less bored and so forth. We're more appreciative. We can lament and so forth. One of the reasons that I chose this particular poem is because time was the enemy when he was punching the clock, and time's still the enemy. He never really worked it out, even though the poem would suggest a certain prosperity, that he's not having to work at whatever age he is, that he does have a boat to go fishing in, that he's got this balsam model in his garage, and that he plays golf, which is a leisure time activity and not necessarily cheap to do. So even in his favorable circumstances, time was still the enemy. He did not know what to do with his time. He had no practice the way we have with mindfulness and our sitting practice in general, that leads to a deeper relationship, a deeper kind of choice. Because the poem, of course, was a sad poem. It's a poem about dukkha, the man having dukkha of actually having his time, but not knowing how to have it, That's sad. That's dukkha, a kind of suffering, a suffering of a kind of meaninglessness, possibly, and looking at that. So time is precious, and we can see it as always disappearing. We can see that we don't have enough, and so forth. So that's one way that we view time, and that affects so much of the decisions we make, how we allocate whatever this is. Second way that we deal with time is that time is fleeting, that it's rushing by so fast. It's not just that it's precious, but it's gone in a swoop. And in fact, that's accurate. That's accurate. From the Buddhist understanding of anicca, that everything is changing, it is not just changing like this, like the seconds of a clock going by. It's like this, faster than we can see. Okay, and in our most still moments in meditation, when we're really deep in and we turn to anicca as to be contemplated, and this is very skillful practice. It's not, I'll come to that in a moment, but what's skillful practice? It's a very skillful practice to contemplate something in this way, any of the Buddha's teachings in this way. And when your mind is really still and you look at things arising and passing, it is overwhelming how fast they're arising and passing. And we start to see that it's passing so fast that we can't possibly have any steadiness of a single moment like that. We kind of relate to a stream of moments because the moment is much faster. I forgot to take my breather here, or water here, so I'm going to have to pause a moment or I'll lose my voice. So that time is fleeting can be an act of assurance at times or an act of lamentation. It can make us very uneasy about how to relate to life, because where do we stand to perceive, to make decisions? We can have a greater sense of it than we realize. And therefore, since we're not really mindful of how deeply we're penetrating into this question, we have the unease without the relationship. That is not a particular desirable situation, to have anxiety but not have any relationship to that which is making us anxious, maybe not even really knowing what it is. There's another thing about time, is that we live in these larger times that we see passing through, and that, you know, of the 60s, it was the age of Aquarius, but we live in the Christian age, or we live in the age of cynicism, we live in these the industrial age, we live where there's large societal movements, cultural movements, that are defining much of the conditions under which our personal time is unfolding. And we can feel our personal autonomy disappearing in this kind of situation. I'm going to give you a poem tonight that somebody will read, and we'll pass out just single sheets that somebody can read, that I will come back to this. So we also live in this mysterious thing that's disappearing as fast as we can even catch a glimpse of it. It's disappearing, and yet somewhere in that darkness of that we can't penetrate, there's also the meaning, the sense of meaning, that how do we feel our way in, not coconut our way in, not conceptualize our way in, but how do we feel our way into a meaningful relationship in the face of time and its fleeting nature, but also in relation to time itself. What is our relationship with time? I've been fascinated with this from my college years on. I was not fascinated by this earlier. I had much more immediate questions that I was fascinated by at that time. But what do we do about this? How do we feel our way into what would be meaningful? We can experiment with various things and see is that meaningful or not. But we can't experiment with that many things. Why not? Because there's not enough time, right? You see the paradox around time. It's such a paradox. So time's precious, time's fleeting. And then in the poems today, the third category is that that one way to meet time is to just meet it now. This moment. Here. Now. Here. Now. This moment. Here. Now. And to develop more and more of a relationship that with all the conditions of life, and including death, including the hard to know what's reliable, all of these different things, to say, well, I'm not going to figure all that out, but I can show up in this moment. I can say that I will live my life. I will have directions as to time in some sort of an arc, but my life is an intentional life. And it's surrendering to now, and the now, how I relate to the now, is based on my deepest intentions. And no matter what my goals, this moment, I would live from my values, which are reflected in these deep intentions, which this is Sama Sankappa in the Eightfold Path of the Buddhas. And he talked about kindness and compassion and renunciation as three moment-to-moment intentions. So that's a possibility. A fourth way I could have chosen many others, but a fourth way to relate to time is to treat it as a mystery, to not thinking that we're going to in any way conquer time or that we're going to fully understand it. But there's ways that we can relate to it that seems to be in harmony with the mystery of it. And that in time, not just in harmony with the mystery of it, but the mystery of us, my particular unfolding, whatever this unfolding is, that came into birth in time and is busily unfolding to its end, that there's a way to feel without, again, understanding necessarily what it is, but it feels harmonious to us. It feels like, yeah, this feels okay. This feels, I feel somehow in proportion with myself. I feel aligned with my values. I don't know what this is, but under a wide range of circumstances as to what it might be, this still feels okay. When I got interested in this subject, I made a list of every possible thing that I could think of that reality might be. And there's not that many, actually, when you sit down, because you might create 100, but those 100 are overlapping. That it's just a different way of saying the same thing. And so for me, the question was, can I find a way to live in time, no matter what this time is around? So let's suppose that time is meaningless. Let's suppose there's no meaning to life. Let's suppose that we're like an organic video game and some other consciousness reality. And we're just sort of like, we're just playing out the hand we are given, that we don't have any real choice at all, and so forth, and on and on and on. We have choice, and there's just observing to say, oh, we'll see how this naturally unfolds. And just like an experiment, in a petri dish. And let's suppose that there's a kind of war that's much of a time in humanity, there's been a postulation that we're involved in this war between good and evil, light and dark, chaos and clarity, chaos and order. All of these, that we're involved in some war. Or maybe that time is about the opportunity for each of us to choose to be kind. That it's all of this is just to choose, that it's all for our individual growth, and it has no meaning. It's just something that's running around to give us a chance to become. And it's this generous gift. It just didn't come with instructions. And part of the challenge is to figure out what the instructions are for ourselves. And so there's no overall meaning at all. There's only the meaning that each of us have and how we relate. Do we relate from anger? Do we relate from caring? What do we do? What do we do with this in a way that helps us become more and more conscious with less and less attachment? And that's this benign meaning of all of this. Might be true, might not be true at all. Maybe all meaningless. It may be a kind of cruel joke. Give these creatures that have embodied awareness an impossible paradox, and see all the different ways that they figure out to try to relate to it. Just watch and see what it is. As you see, I've really done this. And I've done it on retreat also, where they each become very alive and very real. And because I've sat lots of retreats for long periods of time, I've really had the time to do this. I always notice the reference to time in this. And so, whether we consciously choose or not, we are again in some way relating to the mystery of this. Our choices reflect something to do with the mystery. Maybe we have imposed or come up with or been visited with a belief as to exactly what that mystery is, and we're going with that belief. I can't say that I have a belief. I can say that I have a sense of possibility that I've put my chips on. A sense of possibility that makes the most sense, but simultaneously, paradoxically, holding my choices in the sense of all of these meanings. And so do my choices hold up, even if it's meaningless, even if it's predestined, and so forth. I've gone to some degree of this penetrating, having a very conscious relationship levels down. Not advocating that for everyone. That's for a kind of mind that has to do that. But nonetheless, I am advocating that each of us has to is not presented with the opportunity to have maybe a little more freedom by having a conscious relationship to the mystery of time, just as to the now of time, just as to the speed that time is fleeting, just as to the preciousness of how short a lifespan is, and once we've reached how it takes us so long to develop anything, how short a period of time there is to develop it. Whether you're a swimmer, whether you're a tennis player, Venus Williams notwithstanding, it's everything. Really understanding how to practice, you know? You understand how to practice, and you maybe got 40 or 50 years to practice. Not that many. And you don't know if you've got 40 or 50. You may only have 4 or 5 days. It's all mysterious. So how to relate to this? How to relate to this? So I'll pause here for a moment for any woe is me or long begun comments or complaints or questions, if you have any, before we don't have to have, don't feel obligated. But
I have a question about, in the suttas it talks about neons. Mm-hmm. How do you interpret neons?
Well, There's various definitions and various traditions as to how long an eon is, including in the Buddhist tradition. Because you see, from a felt sense, time is unfathomable in ordinary mind states. We can conceptualize it, and conceptualize it in some sort of numbers that we relate conceptually to, or do some sort of magical, like, and it's 1,000 of those. But we can't get a real felt sense. You know, the distance to the furthest star is not something we can feel. We reach a limit in altered mind state of when the mind's not clouded, but there's a clarity in the mind. There's been development over this over many years or decades. That can be more arguable. Like, it's possible to me that the Buddha could fathom this, that his mind had developed to a level that he could do this because it was no longer ordinarily based mind states. I don't know one way or the other. I don't have to know. But I do know that for me and most of my mind states, there's this limitation. So that there's eons means then maybe restate that as time vaster than we can imagine. And that we can feel the infiniteness of time. This is the fifth of the jhana states, is when you can feel the infiniteness of time and space. And then sixth is the consciousness. So when I say time, I really should have said space. That was not a good way to say that. So in one of the poems we're going to read, Yeats is talking about time in what he calls gyres, G-Y-R-E, and they're like these, to him, they're like these 2,000-year periods. And it's really relevant today because are we entering into a new time period on a larger scale, a time of chaos, a time of an irrationalness, a time where violence rules, you know, that violence is the law, you know, and so forth. Some people feel that, as again, we'll come into that. So definitely there is a time where information, our relationship with information has definitely changed. And how long this will last, we don't know, because if everything falls apart, we'll lose all this access to all this information, possibly. And so we don't know, we do know there's these vast spheres of movement of within cultures and humankind. We also know that our planet goes through these vast, vast periods that change, that ordinarily are slow changes, but then when they come, they can come on all at once. And we could be inducing one now, but then something's induced others other times too. So we live, that's part of what this, the anxiety about an individual having a conscious relationship to time is the, to the ego, it's such an insult to be so small, to be so so lacking in agency, and then the idea that it's supposed to have an orientation. So the ego tends to like narrow down, flatten, understandably. But with our practice, we can hold a much larger relationship to time in this way, and the Buddha certainly seems to me to be encouraging that. This is a quote of Jung's, in which Jung says, "Life is a luminous pause between two great mysteries, which yet are all one." Life is a luminous pause. I like that because we have the focus, you know, the downbeat is on life, but here the downbeat is on the other two. This is just a pause between two beats. the time before time and the time after time. This time in terms of this physical being's time, or time, you could take this at any scale you want. A luminous pause and that to me is possibly a gift. Possibly. It's not guaranteed a gift. If you're starving to death and you're sitting being eaten up with disease and you're 2 years old and in some situation, doesn't feel like a gift to that 2-year-old. So, but it's only possibly a gift that we would not care. It would not be that hard to make it a gift for every human being on the planet. It's not our lack of resources that finally stops us from having a bottom line level of life being a gift for everyone. It's our views and opinions. It's our views and opinions that stop that. And then that too we have to live with in time. We have to, it just goes on and on. And is evolution happening in time? Right now, there's this thinking in our country of, that evolution is happening really fast in consciousness. May be true. I don't know. I don't witness that. Although the arguments and descriptions of it are very beautiful, and I find myself, boy, I hope this is true. I hope it's my own blindness that's not allowing me to see this. But I don't see it. I don't see this evolution in consciousness. And yet I have people say to me, what I want to do in this lifetime is be part of that evolution of consciousness. I'm for holding the values for however long they take to just be a place keeper, a place marker, that kindness matters. And then if the whole world is not doing kindness, still, a few people are holding that kindness matters. To me, that is an operable point of view of how to hold in what all's going on in time. But to say, no, this is, I in my lifetime am going to make kindness matter everywhere. I don't see how to do that for myself. But I can hold it. I can hold it in my actions, having that as an intention in my life. Do you see the difference? Any other question or comment? Yes, here, please.
So I'm a little confused.
I couldn't hear that.
I'm a little confused.
Okay, so am I.
So what are you saying is the utility of entertaining all the possible meanings of life and reality? Is it, this is what I think I heard, is it that you find a relationship to time that suits more rather than less of those meanings? Or do you just settle with one for the sake of settling with one? I'm not really...
So what I'm saying is that you already have worked out some version of this without necessarily... You may have had lots of consciousness about it. You may not have. You may have gone with what you were conditioned to think. I don't know. And I remember I said I wouldn't recommend this for everyone. But what I was interested, I wanted to have a conscious relationship with how I was choosing to spend my time, my energy. And I am leery of belief. So therefore, I didn't want to... take a belief that I grew up, of the culture I grew up in, or the belief of someone that writes well or speaks well, or a belief that feels real comfy to me if I choose that. I was leery of not having full participation. And if whether I was right or wrong, I wanted to at least participate. I wanted to dance with life in relation to time. And so that's what I did. I looked at this whole wide range and I tested what I'm doing. I would say, okay, if that's true, I bet on a possibility. But does that possibility hold up in terms of my being comfortable if I'm completely wrong? in terms of these other things? If I suddenly in my lifetime realized this was not true at all, it's completely wrong, this other thing was true or that other thing was true, would that make me bitter, cynical, feel as though I've wasted my time, make me feel as though I had no dignity? I was revealing this to you in part because I'm tired and I'm not censoring as much as I might in other situations, because I don't want to disturb anybody's quietitude time that much. But that was I'm being self-revealing around this in terms of the degree that I have gone through and still go through periodically to test what am I doing with my time. And I make many mistakes about how I allocate my time. Many, many mistakes for different reasons. Some tend to be repeating over and over again, and I slowly try to address those. And sometimes I make mistakes because I'm still trying to figure it out around a particular activity in my time. Is that a wise use or not wise use? And I don't know. I'm still in that there's ambiguity because of lack of information, which is a healthy ambiguity, but you still have to be making a decision. You can't, because of ambiguities, you've all heard the ambivalence and ambiguity talks. If not, they're online, all 5 hours of them. The people in here who did can tell you, it really are 5 hours. That we can't let our ambiguity and ambivalence totally take away our conscious act to choose. Because if we don't consciously act to choose, then we're less getting feedback. We're less getting the friction that leads to development. You know, it's the friction in the pearl, in the clam that makes the pearl. And so there's that's another reason to respond. Does this sort of answer your question?
Yeah, that helps a lot.
Is it short or long?
It's time.
Okay, let's try.
I think what I'm taking away from this whole discussion is that I realize that my whole life has been on a schedule. From the moment I was born, I was scheduled to go to school, I was scheduled to have dinner, I was scheduled to go to bed. Summertime was probably the only time I didn't have a schedule. When I retired, I no longer was forced into a schedule. Not that it was ever forced, but I was there. I had no longer had a schedule. And I struggled with that, and I'm still struggling with that, the lack of a defined schedule. And it's been difficult for me to create that schedule on my own. And that's where my choices and decisions about my use of time comes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to figure out how to schedule my time,
yes,
so that it becomes meaningful to me and productive, all the words you want to use about it.
Yeah.
And helpful.
Yes. Yeah, and you're like, you're not, unlike the guy in the poem, but not as lost as him, maybe. But there is, I hear this a lot because of my other work. In part, there's priorities. In part, there's values that you just want to be manifesting in some way. And in part, there's exploration. There's different things to know this. And it turns out that for many people with no schedule, that becomes the schedule. So that there's a kind of schedule into nothingness, because there's no organizing principle, so nothing happens. But that's a schedule too.
Right, and I can fall into that trap.
Yes, you and most of us. Yeah, so so you can deal with it on the surface, or you can deal with it much more in this, the surround, the 360, as I talk about, the sort of ambulating, well, what is my relationship to time? I know I've got a lot less than I've ever had before, but so whatever this amount's left, what do I want to do with it? On what level am I going to listen? Am I going to listen to my heart's leaning, or am I going to, what gives a sense of worthwhile to me? Not what others will think is worthwhile, unless what I really value is what others think of me. And then I would spend my time doing what would make others think well of me. That would be rational and legitimate. It's not up to me to judge what people would think that is. So, I want to pass out, seven of the poems for today, from today, and I have the side that's got a number on them is the side I want you to look at. Some of them have a poem on the back. Ignore that poem on the back. And two of them, there's a poem called The Second Coming, of which there's two copies, because I'm going to have more people read that. And then I may have these little small poems by this Japanese woman, which I've also got two of, because I'd have this read down. So if we just pass it around the room, just allocate it, just so that people, not everybody's going to, everybody's going to share. And you can't do it that close, you're going to run out of pages soon. It's like every third row or something to have enough. So maybe you could also move your chair. Go to a different chair and to group yourself around something more if you're interested. So I would like someone to start with reading the excerpt from Coleman's Bed. I brought in part of this earlier, so in an earlier talk I gave here.
Trees and rocks, how the discarded is woven into shelter. Learn the way things hidden and unspoken slowly proclaim their voice in the world. Find that far inward symmetry to all outward appearances. Apprentice yourself to yourself. Begin to welcome back all you sent away. Be a new annunciation. Make yourself a door through which to be hospitable. Even to the stranger.
And now pause, and let's have someone else read the second half of that.
See with every turning day how each season makes a child of you again, wants you to become a seeker after rainfall and birdsong. Watch now how it weathers you to a testing in the tried and true. Admonishes you with each falling leaf to be courageous, to be something that has come through to be the last thing you want to see before you leave the world.
So this is David White, and it's his poem called Coleman's Bed. You can write it down if you want to look it up. It's easily available on the web. And this is a poem that I chose. This is someone talking about the preciousness of time. Don't waste it. Don't waste it. Wherever we are, no matter what we've done in the past, don't waste from here. Take advantage of this. Be taught now, among the trees and the rocks, how the discarded is woven into shelter. Everything that we've been already is our shelter for making a choice. All of our losses prepare us to make a decision, because we know how to deal with loss now. To have the courage to do so is the challenge of this. And to find that far inward symmetry to all outward appearances. apprentice yourself to yourself, to kind of have a beginning to start over in a certain way. This can be externally or internally or both. It can be in one aspect of our lives or more than one aspect of our lives. To welcome back all you sent away in yourself. Because with mindfulness, nothing has to be sent away. That doesn't mean that it's indulged in if it's harmful, but that this was part of our history can be owned with kindness, and we can garner wisdom from it. So, you see, with every turning day, each season makes a child of you again. This is, I talked about this quite a bit today, this living time cyclically rather than linear. Because with linear, it's harder to have renewal, because we're thinking that's gone, and we're looking along yesterday, today, and tomorrow. But in cyclical time, which is season time, it's fall, winter, spring, summer, there is this cycle. And I talked about a person that I knew well who did that. Okay, now someone read the Second Coming, please. There's two copies of this.
Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, the blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity.
Thank you. Thank you. So, who else? Another group has this. So one of you read it.
Again?
Yeah, read it again.
Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Your anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity.
And give it to the man next to you, and let him read the second part of this. The little dot means that we switch readers.
Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image of spiritus mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born.
So this is the kind of fear that we have in our society now. And I told the group today that this is, that in the last 30 years, 2016 was like, I can't remember quite, I don't have my notes in front of me, it's been referenced more, it's been looked up, all of this in articles, so forth, in the last 30 years, since they Googled all these publications and all, this poem is now reflecting the tremor of our times, and that the turning, the widening gyre. Gyre is like an eon, like a period of time, and he viewed that as 2,000 years. He, for instance, thought that the Babylonian time period was from 2,000 before the Common Era to the time of Jesus in the Common Era, and that was one, and that the end, that the 20th century was the end of another 2,000, and you know, that's and so this guy in that way, and he saw it as a spiral through time. And it is so, you know, this has stirred hearts and minds for for all of these decades that it's been out. And the Spiritus Mundi is like the soul of the world, the spirit of the world. In that view, we're all aligned to this kind of collective spirit, sort of like Jung's collective unconscious, or like the Kabbalah tree of life, sort of. I mean, there's lots of things in this area that are older than any modern thinking about it. So one thing that people run into trouble with is when we're in a time like this, when things can seem uncertain or meaningless or there's fear, how one stays in personal relationship with time. So I can remember at the time of the invasion of Iraq, how hard that was for me, because I was in such despair, because it was so clear to me and tens of thousands of other people what was going to unfold. None of this is a surprise at all. I mean, anyway, to have to bear that and then live my life when it felt like so huge, what did my life matter, given such a huge thing that was being done wrong, where we were going to destroy a civilization, and all of which we did. I had to struggle with that. And that's not a liberal or conservative view, by the way. That's like seeing the facts of what was unfolding. If no conservative that would have understood this would have said, oh, this meets conservative values. They're a nihilist who would say, fine. But anyway, so it's not it's not a political statement. It's like seeing these larger cultural unfoldings in that way. And so this becomes one of our challenges, is to live with that. And now the third one, please, the atmospherics. Yeats. W.B. Yeats. Well, it's time already, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, we'll just do this one.
Atmospherics. Sometimes on a late, clear night, you can pull that station from Denver or Boston out of the dark. All the elsewheres alter here, as what you remember changes what you think. Not spider, nor plum, nor pebble possess any of the names we give them. A kite tugging on its string gives you a sense of what's up there, though it is translated and by a string. Out there, in the dark, the true thing.
I'm realizing how hard it is to track without having copies in front of you. So we're not going to. I just want to read one more. Read the one that had number four on it. Number four. You've got it? And let him. He's back there. Let him read it. What's going on?
Oh, you want to do it? No,
yeah.
Okay.
This is the last one.
Question for me, now that I am old, is that how to be dead?
Hold your mic more like an ice cream cone. There you go.
The question before me, now that I am old, is that how to be dead, which I know from enough practice, but how to be alive, as these Warren Hills Telltale and some paintings of Paul Cézanne, and this merry-singing wren who thinks he's alive forever, this instant, and maybe.
This is from Sabbath by Wendell Berry, and well worth reading. So this is for many of us, not for the one reading so much, but for many of us in this room, maybe that's right, that we do know how to die. We've had enough practice of living towards death. But the question is how to live. And then that inevitably brings us back to time. And with that, we will close for this for now.
What was the name of the third one?
Atmospherics.
Yes.
And it was by Susan Hutton, H-U-T-T-O-N. Very interesting woman. So, the solution to this is everybody show up at Poetry Day next year so that you won't miss. I'm not altogether kidding about that. It's really a special day for using the non-didactic to find what's really meaningful to us. So it might be worth the investment of a day of your time in terms of how it would affect all the rest of your time. So closing our eyes here, coming into the moment of closing. In time, knowing time.